From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 53 of Little Brother, dated the 25th of September, 2021. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Last Wednesday, Microsoft published a blog post talking about a password-free future for their users. Now, this is something that they've been talking about for some time, a couple of years at least, but the news in this case is that it is now generally available to all users with Microsoft accounts in place of a password. You can use an authenticator app, a biometric confirmation such as facial recognition or a fingerprint, a hardware security token such as a YubiKey or a smart card, or they can send a code to your phone or email. Each of these options comes, of course, with a different set of risks and concerns, but trying to construct a so-called good password and remember it just until you have to change it could potentially be a thing of the past. Of course, you're still able to use a password if you choose, and you can, of course, go with two-factor authentication if you prefer. For the record, I prefer. A critical vulnerability has surfaced for a number of Netgear Nighthawk routers. The bug concerns a parental control service and routers that support Circle. I won't list them all here, but if you use your search engine of choice to locate CVE-2021-40847, you'll be taken to the right place. The vulnerability involves the router being able to download and install unsigned updates to the Circle's service daemon, Circle D, opening the door to our old friend remote code execution. The routers are still impacted, even if you do not engage the service, as it still downloads updates. You can move these routers to alternative firmware such as DDWRT. However, if that's a battle that you don't want to fight, Netgear have released a firmware update for it. So, you all know what to do. Patch your systems. A security researcher who goes by Illusion of Chaos has uncovered some security flaws in Apple's iOS. In Illusion of Chaos blog, they write that they have reported 4 zero-day vulnerabilities this year between March and May, and that 3 of them are still there. When confronted, Apple apologized and gave assurances that it was an error and would be fixed, and it wasn't. As such, Illusion of Chaos has made a disclosure of the flaws. The flaws include giving apps the ability to access all of your identity data without having any of the appropriate permissions by way of the GameD daemon, getting a full list of all installed apps via an XPC endpoint, and getting full information about any Wi-Fi connections that you have active or saved without first having the appropriate permission. I'd tell you to patch your systems, but since Apple hasn't issued a patch and have made it difficult to install alternative firmware, I'm sorry, but you're on your own here. It seems as though the intelligence community uses ad blockers. Why? Well, according to a letter from Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, quote, "The companies that deliver online advertisements also collect vast amounts of sensitive information about users, their movements, web browsing, and other online activities, which is then offered for sale to anyone with a credit card. Indeed, major advertising companies are providing Americans' data to firms in China, Russia, and other high-risk foreign countries. It would surprise nobody if foreign intelligence services were able to acquire that data and put it to use in hacking, blackmail, and influence campaigns." End quote. The intelligence community chief information officer is cited as saying, quote, "The IC has implemented network-based ad-blocking technologies and uses information from several layers, including domain name system information, to block unwanted and malicious advertising content." Redditor Shadow Amazon has reported that, at least briefly this week, looking up Amazon customer service in Google would get you a phone number in area code 206 that would bring your phone calls to a scammer. Details are light, but it appears that the scammer purchased a Seattle phone number and the appropriate Google AdWords to get it up to the top of the results. To get around the problem, don't contact customer service through a number you find on a web search. Instead, get onto Amazon's website and have them call you. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Last month, the Lithuanian government published a report concerning the security of several brands of Chinese-made smartphones, Xiaomi, Huawei, and OnePlus. In their analysis of the Xiaomi device specifically, they raised some concerns about a file that they found which appears to provide a blacklist for content. While this was the initial cause of some concern for the possibility of Chinese censorship being imposed on the rest of the world, this is a concern that could arise from any phone manufacturer anywhere, and as with most things IT, or even life in general, it ultimately comes down to who you feel you can trust. Some concern was expressed over Xiaomi sending encrypted SMS messages to a server in Singapore when you sign up for their cloud storage service, but somehow those concerned neglected to consider the whole matter of cloud services involving, you know, deliberately sending your data to someone else to hold on to. There were fewer concerns with Huawei and none found with the OnePlus. For what it's worth, the mobile development blog XDA Developers did their own teardown of the Xiaomi, using the Lithuanian government document as a template, and found that what Xiaomi was actually filtering was advertisements. Last week, I mentioned ExpressVPN in passing while talking about a bunch of related topics. I felt that maybe some deeper discussion of VPNs is in order. I think as technology, they're not well understood and often mistaken for a magic privacy bullet, so I'd like to take a few minutes and describe the technology, how it works, and what it can and cannot do. So I broke it into three parts, and this will be the rest of today's show. Back in the day, if you were a business with multiple offices and you wanted to connect the computers in one office to the computers in another office, the way to do this was to use a private network. There were a number of ways that these could be built out, depending on geography, local infrastructure, and the size of your company's budget. Network connections between offices could be made using satellites, microwave links, dial-up connections, or wires or fibers that were leased from the local telephone company that would permanently connect one office to another. Network routers and bridges could then be used to connect these to the networks inside each office, and it became possible to connect users in one office to resources in another. With the exception of dial-up, this is still a common practice, though not as much as it once was, because in many cases, they've already built out the infrastructure and are just continuing to use it. In other cases, they may have a performance need that requires it. They are, however, expensive to build and in some cases expensive to maintain. Meanwhile, in the late 90s, a protocol called Point-to-Point Tunneling Protocol, or PPTP, became an internet standard, described in RFC 2637. This was the first VPN protocol, and it was featured prominently in Windows, but also readily available on many Linux distributions, and probably other operating systems as well. PPTP would allow you to connect routers or computers together in a way that mimics an old-school private network, but instead of having its own dedicated physical infrastructure, it would hitch a ride on another data network, using data encryption to keep the content of the traffic private from the other users of the physical network. The network it's writing on could be the internet, or maybe it's some form of shared resource. Anywhere you could establish an IP network, you could run a virtual network over it. In the immediate, this wasn't something of much significance because many internet connections were still performed by dial-up, providing a slow, very slow by today's standards, connection to the internet. If someone wanted to connect their computer to someplace else besides the internet, it was a simple matter of having their modem dial that number instead of dialing your ISP's number and having a computer at the other end willing to answer. I used this technology in the 90s, for instance, to access my university's network from home. Relatively private connections could pretty easily be made between any two places that had landline telephones. ISDN could be used to make the process even faster, but that's maybe a topic for another time. Around that time, though, other internet options began to appear, with fast and permanent connections available, and the internet began to take over as the communications backbone. Broadband was born. Satellite, DSL, TV cable, wireless, and fiber optic cables all became available to the masses, providing connections with speeds measuring in megabits or at least high numbers of kilobits, as long as the place that you wanted to connect to was the internet. And it was much less expensive than the dedicated hardware and links that were being used to connect offices together. But what if you wanted a private connection that wasn't directly part of the internet proper? Something that you wanted to keep the masses of the internet out of? Well, this is where PPTP comes in. Using PPTP, and soon after much better protocols, it was possible for those commercial interests to connect their offices together using a virtual private network rather than a real network. This later grew to a technology that could be used to allow intellectual workers of all stripes to work remotely, something that now has existed for a while, but which became absolutely indispensable last year. So what does this have to do with the average internet user? If we look back again at the dial-up internet days, there was competition for your internet connection. And by that, I mean there was a lot of competition. If you did not like something about your internet provider, you could cancel your account with them and go use another one. This includes whether or not you trust your internet provider. In my case, when I was using dial-up, I used a small local provider. They provided great service, and they were very much hands-off with the product. The folks running the ISP were folks I was able to get to know personally, and I trusted them fully not to snoop or interfere. The three-member family that owned it literally lived in the same building with their data center, and this was their livelihood, but also their life. They had my full trust. I do not get that warm fuzzy from my current ISP, or from their competitor. As broadband took the place of dial-up, you started to see internet service consolidated into the hands of fewer and larger companies. This had two key effects. First off, a small number of broadband internet providers had the ability to monitor the internet activities of a large part of the population, which, to an advertiser, is a juicy body of information, possibly one just a little bit too juicy to resist. Second, these providers became a choke point in the internet. Now, before you ignore the possibility that the internet providers might write off these opportunities, let me point out a couple of things that actually have happened at some point in time. In 2005, TELUS, a nationwide Canadian ISP, was having labor issues. All right, let's call it what it is. They were on strike. A community website called Voices for Change came online where striking workers were able to communicate about their action, coordinate actions such as phone jamming TELUS, share news from the picket lines, etc. Problem is, if you had TELUS for your ISP, you couldn't get to the site. It was blocked by TELUS. How petty is that? In order to get there, you actually had to be a user of the competition. For TELUS employees, that was a smack in the face at the very least. At some point, a proxy was established where TELUS customers could get around the block, and eventually TELUS stopped this behavior in the face of public outcry. But I believe they would have kept this up if they could have. Okay, so that's Canada. How about the U.S.? Well, in some parts of the U.S., we are lucky enough to have more than one ISP. and usually one of them is Verizon in these two ISP towns like Schenectady. By providing a network that is mostly superior, at least in ways that most people care about, they can easily command a larger portion of the market in any place that they offer their Fios product. However, in 2014, Netflix worked very poorly on Verizon's network. Now, keep in mind, this is a network whose whole selling point is blinding fast speed, and the demands of streaming video, while not small, are well within the claimed capability of the network, certainly within the realm of any reasonable expectation that the customers had. So, what was going on? Well, in a nutshell, the arrangements that Verizon had made to connect their customers to Netflix on the internet's backbone, these are called peering arrangements, were not up to the task. We could debate whether or not this was deliberate, but I will say that there were eventually arrangements made where money flowed from Netflix to Verizon and the problem just magically disappeared. Both of these problems are problems that could be solved by using a VPN. In fact, one of the sources I used to compile this piece was an article written by Renee Biana for VPN Pick in 2014, and she was able to explain in her article how much nicer Netflix ran when she routed her traffic out of her home via her VPN, bypassing the choke point in Verizon's network. So that covers what a VPN is and how it can be useful. And now part two, who do you trust? When you use one of the commercial VPN services, they can offer you a bunch of things that may or may not be useful to you. In essence, they can do three things. First, they can get around blocks in the internet. Second, they can obfuscate your location. And third, they can protect your traffic from local interference. Ultimately, though, all that a VPN service does is take your internet traffic to some other location and drop it onto the internet there. Getting around blocks is something I already discussed in part one, so I won't go into a lot of detail here, but the important thing to understand is that if you can't get to something on the internet but you can get to a VPN that can get there, you can use that VPN to solve the problem. Obfuscating your location can be kind of useful at times. If you travel a lot, whether for work or not, you can use your VPN to keep your location to yourself. Websites that you use won't see anything different about your traffic when you're sitting in a hotel halfway around the world than they will when you are sitting at home, in your office, or at a cafe with a public Wi-Fi. This could be useful, for instance, if you have a stalker. Obfuscating your location can also be expanded out into specifically misdirecting your location. As an example, if you have some website that you want to use in another country, and that website does not allow access to your country for whatever reason, all you need to do to get past that is get yourself on a VPN that's hosted in the country that you want them to believe you're in. This can be especially useful with streaming media services, which often constrain access to their content by country. Technically, this is both obfuscating your location and getting around a block. However, local interference is the biggie. If you are using your VPN from your home, it can prevent your internet provider from treating any of your traffic any differently than any other. And this can be especially relevant if you are using your connection to do something that your ISP doesn't approve of, such as torrenting Linux ISOs. If you are someone who has to use public or corporate Wi-Fi, however, a VPN will keep the owners of that Wi-Fi network from altering or examining your traffic. But more importantly, it will keep other users of the Wi-Fi from doing the same thing to you. But I called this part, "Who do you trust?" for a reason. If you don't trust your ISP, you can find a VPN that you do trust and use them to shift the balance of power so that you don't need to be afraid to use the internet. If you lose your trust in your VPN provider, you can find yourself another one and the problem is solved. Or is it? Can you trust your VPN? Keep in mind, their only real role is to make your traffic appear like it's coming from someplace else, removing your ISP from the trust equation, but inserting themselves into it instead. Can you trust them? Now part 3. Can you trust ExpressVPN? Let's start with why we're asking this question in the first place. The answer comes in the form of a tweet from Ed Snowden. Very short, as tweets tend to be, and straight to the point, he writes, "If you're an ExpressVPN customer, you shouldn't be." Why? Well, let's start with the question of the CIO. For those not completely familiar with C-level executives, the CIO is the Chief Information Officer, the person who is ultimately in charge of the information technology of an organization. This is probably well understood by most of my listeners, but I want to make absolutely sure we're all on the same page here, so please bear with me. This is the person who approves the technology decisions and oversees how the technology is selected and deployed. VPNs are information technology services. What I mean by that is that the very service that they offer is a product of the company's information technology department. As such, it is completely reasonable to view the CIO as being the corporate officer who is primarily responsible for overseeing the creation of the very product that the company sells. The CIO of ExpressVPN, as I mentioned before, is a guy named Daniel Garrick. Garrick is a former U.S. intelligence operative. I'm not going to pass judgment on that point because such folks are ostensibly there to keep the country safe. But for this to work, it is absolutely imperative that they are loyal. Unfortunately, loyalty isn't rewarded, and hence Edward Snowden, also a former U.S. intelligence operative, was stranded in Russia by our government for putting his loyalty to the people over his loyalty to the government. So make of that what you will. However, Garrick is not loyal. This isn't conjecture, this is established fact. As I mentioned last week, he and two other U.S. intelligence operatives were fined a total of $1.7 million for taking part in equipping the Emirati government with cell phone busting spyware. Now, let me be clear, the penalty was not for having or deploying the software, but for deploying it for someone else. While discussing this, a fellow Redditor going by the name of Senna Arterian asked me a pretty good question. He writes, "Just playing devil's advocate, but wouldn't the best person to design a security system be a spyware developer? I would have thought having tons of red team experience would help with fortifying blue team defenses, but maybe I have the incorrect understanding of the facts in the current scenario." Well, as it happens, that is exactly the argument that ExpressVPN is making. In a blog post from earlier this month, they wrote, "We've known the key facts relating to Daniel's employment history since before we hired him, as we disclosed them proactively and transparently from the start. In fact, it was his history and expertise that made him an invaluable hire for our mission to protect users' privacy and security." Senna Arterian is absolutely right here, and so is ExpressVPN. In terms of using this experience as a gauge of Garrick's skill level, in fact, let me give credit where credit is due. It's actually spot on ExpressVPN's part to choose a CIO who has demonstrated that he has skills akin to those who will be working for him. It's very clear that this is someone who can do the job. But can you trust him? My concern is not to do with his skills and his abilities. It is wholly based on the open questions about where his loyalties lie. For their part, ExpressVPN's loyalties appear to lie with Garrick. On Monday, ExpressVPN wrote, "While we in no way wish to diminish the sincerity of the concerns we've heard, we want to reassure you that we have considered them extensively and we do not share them." The entry goes on to reiterate the stance that the best defender is someone who has worked for the offense. In a way, this is the whole point of the penetration testing sector of the security industry. Nonetheless, I hope they will pardon me for being unpersuaded, but that's me. And that brings me back to my fellow Redditor, Senna Arterian, who later added this. "So, personally, I think now we were all led to discuss the wrong topic the entire time. That was an amazing distraction by the adware team over at Cape Tech, that had everyone distracted by the current CIO as the entire upper management made a shadow switch. Amazing play, and I absolutely think everyone using ExpressVPN needs to ditch it ASAP. LOL. So what are they talking about? Well, the answer can be found prominently in ExpressVPN's blog, where they are bragging about their merger with Cape Technologies. So who are Cape Technologies? Well, the answer is, they're another VPN service, offering a product called CyberGhost. Well, when CNET reviewed it about a year ago, their finding was that their app and their website had an excessive number of trackers, an impotent ad blocker, and manipulates the traffic. In other words, they are everything that a VPN service should not be, and everything that you're using a VPN to get away from. Now, I'll still leave it to you to decide for yourself, but from everything I can see, this company seems like a poor choice, and that may be very well getting even worse. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Fungaboo, Knight Rider 007, Azrael, Senna Arterian, and Shadow Amazon for their contributions to the various stories. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80, and our theme music is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can send me a message on Reddit. My handle there is Freakature, Phreakiture, and I'd love to hear from you. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well.